If you spoke to John Stuart Mill and said, why did the bottle break? He would say, A, because it was brittle, and B, because someone threw a stone at it. As our well-informed but unimaginative students would say, a number of factors have to be taken into account. We could argue about it until we were blue in the face, but I would argue we would never agree on what the main cause was. We could initiate a debate in the Journal of Bottle Studies, but the debate would never, ever be resolved, because what we see as the main cause is not objective, it's not testable, it's subjective. It depends on our interests and purposes. Now here, this is a rather dull example, because A, bottles are rather dull, but B, there's only two factors, the brittleness and the stone. What I'm saying is, even when there's only two factors, we can't agree on what the main one is. Imagine now something like the outbreak of World War I or the outbreak of the Russian Revolution. You might have scores of factors. So if we can't decide which of two factors is the most important with broken bottles, how on earth are we going to decide what the most important factor is in the outbreak of World War I or the outbreak of the Russian Revolution? At this point, historians like to say things like, oh, what we need is more research. If only we knew more about bottle breaking in 17th century Bohemia, we could come up with the answer. Mill is replying, it's not a matter of a lack of information. It's not that we lack. In fact, the more information we had, the more difficult it would be to list all of the factors in a hierarchy of causes. So I don't believe that with our bottle we could have an agreed hierarchy of causes. Let's say, just for the sake of argument, that we all argued until we were blue in the face, but eventually we decided that the throwing of the stone was the main factor. I don't believe we can do that, but for the sake of argument, let's say we could. Immediately, that main factor would cease to be an explanation and would become an explanandum. It would require explanation itself. So why did the person throw the stone? Were they bored? Were they bored because they were unemployed? Did they have an unresolved Oedipal complex? What seemed to be the most fundamental cause would turn out to have causes of its own. Once more, we would have multiple interacting causes. I've gone on about bottles for far too long, so let's return to the far more interesting case of late medieval England. Just like our bottle, we could ask this question, why did the English peasantry win its freedom in the later Middle Ages? In two ways. Firstly, we could say, why did the English peasantry win its freedom in the later Middle Ages? And the answer seems to be because of an event. Throwing the stone, it is population decline, which explains why the peasants won their freedom. But we could also read the question as, why did the English peasantry win its freedom in the later Middle Ages? I.e., why did the English peasants win its freedom as opposed to the peasantry in Eastern Europe or the peasantry in 17th century Bohemia? The answer then seems to be because there were strong peasant communities that could resist their landlords. Here we have an emphasis not on an event, like throwing the stone, we have an emphasis on a long-term condition, the strength of the peasant community, rather like the brittleness of the bottle. John Stuart Mill would say, why did the English peasants win its freedom in the later Middle Ages? Because A, population declined, and B, there was a strong peasant community to take advantage of this new situation, of the new bargaining position that the peasants had. We can argue until we're blue in the face. We can initiate a grand debate in past and present. I would argue that the debate is irresolvable. Why did the English peasantry win its freedom in the later Middle Ages? Because A, population declined, and B, there was a strong peasant community. A number of factors have to be taken into account. Let's say, however, we could agree that the strong peasant community was the key factor. I don't think we could, but certainly nobody did agree what the key factor was in the end of serfdom. Let's say that we did agree it was the strength of the peasant community. Immediately, the strength of the peasant community would require explanation. Is the peasantry strong in the West? I don't know, because of open field agriculture, cooperative agriculture. The peasants are used to working together and socially organizing together. Is the peasantry weak in the East? Because of the role of the state. But the state allies with the landlords and enserves the peasants. What seems to be the key factor, the strength of the peasant community, would in fact then require a more fundamental cause as its explanation. Okay, so let me draw all this together. Basically, what I'm saying is, historians who come up with a new cause in history, let's say population decline for the end of serfdom, or strong peasant communities for the end of serfdom, this is an incredible achievement. Not many of us, as historians, come up with important new causes of things. So to have identified a new cause is a great achievement. It's like finding a new piece of the jigsaw puzzle. But what tends to happen is that historians are so proud of having found the piece of the jigsaw puzzle that they wave it around and they go, look, I found the most important piece of the jigsaw puzzle. But of course, there's no most important piece of the jigsaw puzzle. The picture you get of the jigsaw are all of the pieces put together. And the same is true for causes. There is no most important piece of the jigsaw. There is no most important cause. Before I finish, let me deal with two objections which people often come up with. Firstly, because I am skeptical about identifying the most important cause, people often say to me, therefore, you're skeptical about historical knowledge. And because we're all historians, we can't afford to be skeptical about historical knowledge. If historical knowledge doesn't exist, well, people can then deny that the Holocaust took place and so on. We're all committed to the idea of historical truth and historical knowledge. But I'm not denying historical knowledge. I'm denying knowledge of main causes in history. I'm not denying that drugs have effects. I'm denying that they have objective side effects. Similarly, I'm not denying that we can know causes in history. What I'm denying is that we can identify the most important cause. So my position is not a skeptical one about historical knowledge in general. It's a skeptical one about this particular piece of knowledge. The final objection, which I get often from people who teach students, is that I seem to be encouraging students to be, as E.H. Carr said, well-informed but unimaginative. I seem to be welcoming students ending their essays by saying, thus, in conclusion, a number of factors have to be taken into account, something which we all seem to agree is a bad thing. Now, what I would say is that when we ask our students to produce hierarchies of causes, what we're actually asking them to do is to be interesting and imaginative and analytical. But there are other ways to make our students come up with interesting, analytical, and imaginative arguments without demanding that they produce spurious hierarchies of causes. For instance, we could say, instead of saying, what was the main cause of World War I, we could say, why did the diplomatic crisis of 1914 cause a war when previous similar diplomatic crises didn't create a war? That would be stretching our students. They'd have to be analytical and imaginative, but it wouldn't ask them to answer a question which cannot be answered. What was the most important cause of World War I? Similarly, instead of saying, what was the main cause of the Russian Revolution, you might say, can sociological theories of revolution help us understand what happened in Russia in 1917? to bring two bodies of knowledge together, theories of revolt and revolution, and a particular historical case study. Similarly, rather than saying what was the main cause of the rise of Hitler, we could do a comparative analysis of the rise of Hitler compared to that with other right-wing dictators, Franco or Mussolini or whoever. In other words, there are better ways of stretching our students and testing their abilities than asking them to attempt the futile task of listing causes in their order of importance. By now, I've probably gone on too long. You're probably wishing that my train had broken down or that I was strangled at birth. I'll throw it over to you for questions. I'm sure you'll tell me why I'm wrong. It's just that I don't think you'll come up with the main reason why I'm wrong.
I'm just wondering if I'm a